There's never been a way to follow up with the patient to say, hey, you're not here with us, but we would love to know how you're doing. We'd love to know what's going on with you so that we can make sure you continue to get care.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Welcome, Lauren, to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast.
Thanks, Bob. I'm really excited to chat today.
Lauren, there are many dimensions to the use of AI, and particularly in healthcare. And I want to cover Vidara's use of AI technology today. And also another very important topic, the critical role of model cards when selecting an AI vendor. So if it's okay with you, let's start with the technology. So Vidara is now entering your fifth year. So congratulations.
Yeah.
Share with us your experiences using AI technology to analyze human language and emotions in your previous company and how that led into behavioral health.
Oh, great question. Yeah. So I was the CTO at a company called HireVue, started by Mark Newman, who also started Vidara Health with me. And Mark invented this idea of a one-way job interview where you could set like a set of questions, ask everybody the same questions, and get to know them at a deeper level than the resume. A resume is not a very good view of who a person is. It might not be written by them. It might not even be accurate. But if you could listen to that person and hear them, and see everybody who'd applied, instead of being limited to, I have 4 hours a week to do phone interviews. Now you could see everybody very quickly and just watch them and get to know them. And it was asynchronous. So you could just send this to a job candidate. They would answer the questions on their own time. And then you'd have 20 job interviews to watch and you'd go through them and quickly you'd go through, oh, not a fit, not a fit. Oh, this person's incredible. Let me send them to the rest of my team. So that was the idea of the video-based job interview we did at HireVue. And the problem with a video is it takes a while to watch. The advantage of a resume, and maybe the only advantage of a resume, is you can quickly make a decision, a bad decision probably, but you can make a decision quickly. And so we sought out to build AI that would watch the interview and listen to that candidate, understand who they are, and be able to predict, is this person a good fit for this job? And so if you had 1,000 people apply, you could quickly figure out who are the top 10 people for this job that then we could go and meet personally and get to know them and interview them properly. And so that's where this started, was building AI for job interviews.
Wow. So did you guys do a lot? I heard something like 100 million interviews with HireVue.
Yeah, I just went and checked the number with them. They've done 80 million job interviews now on that platform, and I think it was 190 countries around the world.
I think it's pretty interesting, thinking about actually using video to start to do deeper analysis. There's a lot of different things out there. There's the Gottman Institute. It's up there in Seattle, and it's a marriage counseling institute, and they take a couple and put them in there, and they ask questions. They look at their expressions. They hear their voices, and they have a very high rate of predictability of whether people will stay married or not. When you hear stuff like that, you go, yeah, I don't believe that. Prove it. They've done that for many years and they have proof and it does work. And seeing that you've done something like this with HireVue, being able to look at that in a space of doing interviewing, how did that move into this new model, this new world of behavioral health? You're not a behavioral health clinician. You're a technologist guy, right?
Yeah, I'm a computer scientist by background. And once we built HireVue, it was pretty novel what we were doing. We were taking traditional job interviews, traditional job assessments, and just predicting that from people talking about in an open-ended way. And that hadn't really been done before, certainly at scale. And people kept saying, coming to us and saying, this is amazing technology. Could you apply it in healthcare? And in a job interviewing company, that doesn't make a lot of sense. That's not what investors signed up for. And so Mark Newman and I started thinking about that problem. Same things that we'd learned at HireVue, but could we build a platform that would be focused on healthcare? And the problem that it's cool technology, but what problem does it really solve? And there are a lot of things you can do with this technology, and the Gottman research is fascinating. I've seen it for a long time, but fundamentally, when you leave a healthcare provider, when you're with a healthcare provider, you get pretty good care. You get good their attention, you get their knowledge, their expertise. And then when a patient leaves the provider, they're really on their own. And there's never been a way to follow up with the patient to say, hey, you're not here with us, but we'd love to know how you're doing. We'd love to know what's going on with you so that we can make sure you continue to get care. And that was really the problem that we were trying to answer, is how could we scale follow-up to make sure people weren't left alone in our healthcare system.
So at Bidera Health, you're really talking about an ethical use of video and AI to really improve healthcare and prioritize and accessibility. So how do you use AI to engage mental health patients conversationally? You're doing this through conversation?
Yeah, when we say it's conversation, it's AI-based conversation. And so I think it's important you said ethical, because there are a lot of questionable things. And hopefully when we talk at the end a little bit about model cards, we can dive more into this. But very important to think about the ethics and the impact on everybody who's using these kinds of technologies. Yeah, so I think the way that we think about this is wherever somebody is on their patient journey, whether it's before they've even got to the provider, could we find out background information about them that wouldn't show up in the chart you fill out in the waiting room? Like, what's really happening with this person before they get to the provider so the provider can approach it with the most knowledge? Or after you leave an appointment where you got a diagnosis, say for an anxiety medication, and you start to take it, is it working after you leave? Like, you're not going to know that it's working or not working on the day of your next appointment. There's some lonely period in there where the patient's trying to figure out, is this working? Is it not working? I feel weird. Is this right? It's probably right, because the doctor wouldn't have given it to me if it wasn't the right thing to be doing. But if you could check in, and the way that check-in looks is we send them a text, we send them an email, say, hey, we'd love to hear from you. They click a link, they go into a secure environment and answer questions. And it's just really, how have you been doing? What's been going on with you the last couple of weeks? And they might say, I'm fine. And maybe they are fine, and that's it.
Is this done asynchronously, or do you have a provider on the other end of that conversation?
This is all asynchronous, because we don't have providers who have time to follow up in between visits. They're doing visits.
That's a problem.
We have a massive disparity between the number of people that need to see providers and the number of providers that we have. And so we, even if it's just seeing the people who need to be seen face-to-face, we don't have enough people, let alone doing follow-up in between the visits. And so that's where we're trying to scale providers and give them sort of superpowers to see what they can't normally see so the patients aren't left alone.
Well, how's the video being used here? If I'm answering questions on an app and it's a secure environment and you're actually seeing me answer those questions, I take it, right? You're just not looking at the text of my answers, but you're actually looking at how I respond, with whether I have a smile or whether I look disturbed or whether I'm frustrated. Are you actually trying to analyze some of that video?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're trying to see what a provider, a trained provider, would see if they were looking at you, even though they're not available to look at you right now. So we're training these algorithms on what are the things that Bob does when he's anxious or when he's depressed, and build models that can notice those things. It's a combination of the words that you speak. It's a combination of the tone of voice and the sounds you're making and what we can see about you in terms of your facial expressions, et cetera.
Wow, that's scary.
yeah, I think it is. And I think one of the things that's important here is not everybody wants to be on video, right? And some people can say, hey, I don't want to be on video, turn off the camera, or I'm in a messy spot, or, and sometimes those things are predictive of where they're at and what's going on behind them. But we want to make sure that we'll engage patients in whatever way they're comfortable engaging. Sometimes we're like, I just can't talk right now. I'm on the bus. Can I just text? And so for some of the things we're trying to measure, like anxiety, depression, trauma, we can build a text-based measurement for that. It might take a few more turns of the conversation to get the data necessary. So that's completely okay. There are certain things that we measure, and I'd love to talk about some of the things that are very unique to video. You have to be on camera. Like, we just can't measure it from anything else.
I guess you can instruct your patients to be in a prepared situation where they aren't being distracted, where they do have a quiet place, where they can communicate without any type of interference. So what I'm hearing is, I know a lot of people use AI as a note-taking process, but this sounds like it's way more than just note-taking. Is this used on the intake process at all, or following up, monitoring follow-ups as well?
Yep. It's used at intake, before you've seen the provider, in between visits, and probably the most common use case for these assessments, we can talk about note-taking as well if you want, is following up after care. Like, you've left SUD treatment. We know that people often relapse on their road to full recovery. How do you follow up and check in with patients to make sure that the treatment they got continues to work, that they're not relapsing, they're not decompensating, and do they need more support?
Is it safe to say that patient follow-up is an Achilles heel of the behavioral mental health care model?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we know that if people are followed up on, suicide rate goes down. Just if someone reaches out and said, hey, we're here for you, that can improve suicide rates. We know that you're 100 times at higher risk at any other time of your life right after you were discharged from inpatient mental health treatment. So there's no way to follow up at scale, but we know that people are most likely to take their own life right after they were told, hey, you're good to go home on your own. And it's not that nobody cares. It's just there's nothing built into our system that staffs for that or can resource that until you apply technology to do that follow-up and check in with people to help save their lives.
So do you have any case stories or histories where you're able to find the needle in the haystack that using your technology, you actually, wow, we did it. We saved someone's life, or we intervened in a meaningful way. Is that like a big exception, or do you find that to be more common now?
Yeah, I think we have some great stories of that. I'm happy to share a couple. And in particular, suicide is a really tricky one, because for a lot of suicide attempts, the person wasn't thinking about it even a few hours before the attempt. Sometimes it's almost a spontaneous act. It comes into their head and they act on it. And so timing is very important. There's a story of a young man who went to one of our customers. He was hospitalized for severe depression. I think he was 17 years old, got on the right medication. He left. He was stable, went to his primary care doctor, who said, oh, you shouldn't be taking that. And of course, he listens to the doctor and stops taking it. And then a short time later, I think it was about a week later, he was now quite depressed again. And now it's worse than he was before, because now he's ashamed of failing treatment. He doesn't want to tell his parents, who he's living with, that he's back to where he was before. And there's just a lot of going on with him, and he was done. He was ready to take his own life. And he got the reach out from Vidara that day, and he was home alone. No one was with him. He had a plan and said, how are you doing? And he answered the questions very authentically. Our AI immediately recognized that he was in a crisis, alerted the hospital that had seen him a week before, who normally wasn't able to follow up with people, right? And so as they immediately got an alert from us, looked at the videos. Now, instead of just getting a score back, a number, they were able to get a score, some quantitative data, but also watch what he's saying and what he's talking about and go, okay, this young man's in crisis. We need to reach out. So they were able to reach out, get it, convince him to come back and get more treatment. And what he said the next day was, if you hadn't reached out yesterday, I wouldn't be here today. That was my one cry for help. And this is why technology is so crucial, is because people are out there, they're suffering, they're on their own, they feel alone. But if someone knew, we do have resources, we do have ways to help them get better and save their own life.
There's definitely a shortage of providers, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the things that we've heard a lot, and I've talked to a number of people about this, is that we need an awakening. There's a huge gap here between behavioral mental health and the rest of healthcare. Cancer patients, they have cancer and they also have mental health concerns. And diabetes patients, they got diabetes and they also have mental health concerns.
Yeah.
So, you know, how we go about closing that gap, but what I'm hearing from you is that the technology that we have might be one of the key influencers to help bring that a little bit closer.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've focused a lot on understanding where people are at in their journey through life and getting them to the right care. And part of that's making sure that the limited number of providers we have are seeing the people who need them the most. We still have a lot of inequity in our system of insurance doesn't pay well for mental health. And so a lot of providers only take cash. That skews it to people who can afford to pay cash and takes providers away from people who don't have those resources. And so There's a lot of things we need to do on the business side of healthcare to create more equity. And I do think that AI will play an increasing role in supporting people when there is no human, really providing some form of talk therapy, some form of cognitive behavioral therapy, not as a replacement for people, but as an adjunct. So maybe our therapists can see more people when they're augmented with technology that can do some of the work for them.
You know, I recently had the opportunity to interview Dr. Robbie Pearl, and he's the well-known author of ChatGPT MD. And his book was very interesting. And I would say the major thesis of his book was to use AI by both the providers and the patients in order to get away from the fee-for-service model and really move into value-based care. And, you know, I think you can start seeing the benefits where you can check in, you can stay closer, you can be in more contact, you can find out information easily, all the different Internet of Things devices where you can gather information from the patients and interact with them can really make a big improvement on the healthcare. Do we need to have a new payment model? Do we need something which basically provides patient monitoring code that doesn't require 20 minutes of the provider's time? Because there's a shortage, like you said. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I think we've added like remote patient monitoring to reimburse for some of this. But if it still takes 20 minutes of the clinician's time they don't have, then they either can't get reimbursed. They put in 10 minutes. That's 10 minutes they couldn't do something else, but they still can't get reimbursed. So we have to move to codes that do things that add true value to the patient outcomes. In a way, psychiatry has had a recurring revenue model for a long time. If a patient gets better, they stop coming, right? And in most businesses, you want a recurring revenue model. You're like, I need to retain my customers. And in psychiatry, you want to get, you need to cure them and move on. And that's very difficult. That isn't really the way it works. And so we do need to move towards an incentive where you say, no, I'm being paid to keep people healthy. I make more when my patient population is well versus I make more when they're sick. And I'm not saying that any individual provider is thinking I need to keep my patients sick, but the whole structure of the system is set up with that in mind.
So you've been at this for a little bit more than 5 years. Is it hard to get people to adopt the thinking that you're expressing, the new way of trying to be more efficient, be more engaged? Is that a heavy burden? Are people following your path now?
Yes and no. I think that when we started out, we would show this technology and we would show that a patient can engage and we could send you this data back and everybody would agree like, oh, that's amazing data. This would be so valuable to have. Or great, when would you like to sign up to start using it? Like, oh no, we wouldn't use it, but everyone else should. And the reason is because they're like, I don't know how to pay for it. There's not a way for me to make more money to pay for this. And so people just aren't able to do it. And I think sometimes it's like, no, you actually could. Let's walk through how to do that. And there's like, yeah, you actually will just have to bear more cost if you decide to use this technology. It is the right thing to do. And everyone would agree with that. But it is very hard to get people to do things that just add cost. What's interesting is, I think the uptake of clinical note-taking, which isn't reimbursable, but what it does is it frees up provider time. And that burden on providers is so high today to meet all of the documentation needs and all the administrative burden that we put on healthcare providers. It's such an interesting example of like, you can solve that problem. They're like, hey, I'll pay for that. You're like, wait a minute. Just a minute ago, you said you didn't have a way to pay for new cool technology. Like, oh, but I'd pay for that. And we've had that conversation with a number of customers who, well, that is such a high burden on our providers and providers are pulling it because it directly benefits a provider to say, yeah, I can use this technology and I can spend an hour less a day writing notes. I don't have to spend my nights and weekends catching up on paperwork. I can just do it right then, review it, sign it, and I'm done. So I think there is a little bit of, if the benefit is big enough, people will pay for it regardless. And I think people are finding that note-taking is just an easy entry point to AI that does have enough benefit that it doesn't matter. I shouldn't say it doesn't matter what it costs, but the fact that it doesn't produce additional revenue does have real ROI to them.
I think it's amazing what you've done transforming from an HR video interviewing process into a behavioral health facilitating model. That's pretty impressive use of technology and really being quite curious on how to solve new sets of problems. So, Lauren, let's switch to another very important topic that I mentioned earlier, And that's the critical role of model cars, M-O-D-E-L, cards, not model cars, but model cards, when selecting an AI vendor. So one of the goals of our podcast is to share insights and ideas and to learn from others. And I will confess right now, until I read your recent blog, which we'll put at the bottom of this podcast, I did not know anything about model cards or the organization called the Coalition for Health AI. It's time for you to take us to school on model cards. Tell us, who came up with this concept? Let's get started on this conversation.
It's a great question. And I don't know who came up with the concept. It's been around for a long time, but I am still surprised how many AI vendors don't know what they are. We had a vendor angry at us recently for talking about this because, like, why are you talking about model cards? What are those model cards? And if you're an AI vendor selling software, you should know this. So, you know, the idea of a model card is to describe, does it work? Is this thing going to do the things that it says it will do? So if you say, we can take 3 minutes of speech from a person in a particular, like you ask them these set of questions, they answer on video or audio or whatever, and you're claiming you can predict the PHQ-9 score from that or a depression diagnosis, can you do it? And no model is generally perfect. So there's some false positive rate, some false negative rate. But you'd like to know, how good is the model? Is it like better than random? Hopefully. Is it 100%? Probably not. But how many times is it right and how many times is it wrong? That's really important to know if you're going to start using AI to guide clinical decision making.
Yeah. So right. You mentioned the PHQ-9. That's the Patient Health Questionnaire 9. I think Pfizer came up with that. It's one of those many questionnaires that the clinician uses to try to help assess you, right?
Exactly. It's 9 questions. And part of what we've tried to do at Vidara is collapse those. So from this few minutes of discussion with an AI, we can measure the PHQ-9 and the GAD-7 and the PCL-5 and all these different surveys, which are normally 40 survey questions that measure 4 things. We're replacing that with analyzing open-ended conversation.
So it's not just whether the AI actually works, but does it actually work for your diverse patient population?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's not just, is it accurate, but is it really accurate for white people, but not so much for Hispanic people? Is it really good for men, but for women, not so much? Or cross-sectional? Is it great for white men, but not African-American women? Like, you need to know those things, and you need to know, are there different error rates for those different populations, and are they significant? And what's interesting in the HR field that we were in, that's a regulated space. If you have a model that predicts differently for different demographic groups, like, that's illegal, right?
Yes.
In healthcare, it's kind of, we probably shouldn't do that. And so we got really used to building these model cards for all the models we built. And of course, it made sense when we came to healthcare to say, we really got to have model cards for our models because you have to have those if you want to be fair and accurate.
So when we start thinking about this model card ideology, we know it's important. Really, a lot of people want to whitewash the word AI. They just put AI on it and say, yeah, we're AI, but where did your model come from? Who was it trained on? What can and can't it do? How do we know it works? Yeah. Is that the purpose of this model card, is to install confidence? This thing just wasn't, hey, I have AI in my name, K-A-I-S-E-R. So I'm an AI guy, right? So is that the idea behind this, is to really give some validation?
Absolutely. It should build confidence in the vendor. And if you have 3 different vendors, you should be able to lay out the model cards. There's not a uniform agreement on the format. That's what Coalition on Health AI is trying to come up with. But generally, you should be able to lay these aside and go, this was trained on 10,000 people, and this was trained on 100. That's concerning. Or this one has group differences between gender, and this one doesn't. Okay, that's a good data point. This was never trained on anybody over the age of 18, but all my patients are over the age of 18. This probably isn't indicated for use with my population. And so it really should guide anyone trying to build AI. And this shouldn't be complicated. This should be like, you read the thing and you go, I'm okay with the way it was trained. It seems like it's pretty accurate. It doesn't have demographic differences. It's indicated for use for my population. And this other vendor didn't meet all those criteria, that's a pretty good indication that one vendor is a better fit for you than another.
So how far should you open the kimono, so to speak? So for example, if I have an AI algorithm and I'm using it to classify retinopathy on eyeballs, I may consider that to be proprietary information. And I don't want to reveal that. On one hand, you want to be validated and make people feel good. On the other hand, you want to protect your intellectual property. Is there a conflict there?
Yeah, there's definitely a potential conflict. But I think we think about that a lot of how can we be transparent without enabling our competitors who may not have done the rigorous work that we've done? How do we not give them a competitive edge and let them copy us without doing the hard work we've done? So there's a balance there. I don't know there's a perfect answer there. I think you should be as transparent as you possibly can be without compromising the value of your own product and your own intellectual property. And I don't think I haven't found a perfect answer to that, but I think you should always lean as far as you can towards transparency.
Yeah, there's a tendency to say, hey, this is a black box solution. Just trust me, it works, okay? And that's not very satisfying, I think, at times, especially when you start to talk to the FDA. And the FDA, you guys are an FDA-approved digital platform, and more is being done about that going forward. I think there's going to be more and more requirements and qualifications to get that stamp of approval, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you also want to, by the way, we're FDA registered, not FDA approved. Just want to be very transparent there. As software as a medical device, I think we don't want to put so much regulatory burden in place that new entrants to the market can't bring innovations. And I think we could put so many barriers up that only the Googles and the OpenAIs and the Microsofts can compete when small companies, and we're a small company, have really interesting innovations. So I think there's a balance there. We would lean towards being cheaper so smaller companies like us can get in the market.
Being a novice on this whole conversation here, should I think of this model card as a well-defined, structured, when someone says, I'd like to see your model card? Oh, yeah. And I would have certain categories of information that's covered, or is it more loosely defined than that?
Broadly, it is a little bit vague. I think Coalition for Health AI has a standard template. I like the template in general, but sometimes for a certain model, some of the things don't quite make sense.
Okay.
So I think that there should be some key elements in there. And I think the key elements are what kind of data was it trained on? Obviously, you're not going to share the data because sometimes it's patient data. How accurate is it? When is it wrong? For who is it wrong? And then where should you use this and where shouldn't you use this? Those are the key questions I feel like a model card should be answering. And you can generally do that without giving up all your secrets.
Well, I'm delighted to know that we're moving in that direction. I think ethical aspect of AI is such an important part. And I know that's core foundational to what you're doing with your company, and your leadership is appreciated there. Final thoughts, final words. How would you like to close up? What's the message to the audience that you'd like to talk about the future of how you're dealing with this world of behavioral health?
That's such a big question. I think the message that I'm usually telling people is like, look, AI is here. I think we all know it's here. It's coming. It's this freight train coming at us. We're not going to stop it. We're not going to change it, but it's going to affect all of our lives. And I think we need to lean into that and be very thoughtful about, we're going to be using it. It's going to be part of our lives, but can we use it in a way that's ethical and truly impacts people for good? And whenever you're using AI, I think it's really healthy to say, okay, who is impacted by this? How is a provider impacted? How is a parent impacted? How is a patient impacted? How is the community impacted by the use of this? And I think if we could all broaden our perspective and think about what are the consequences of doing a thing with AI, we'll collectively make better decisions. Because AI could be help the world turn out really badly or incredibly well. There's sort of two potential futures here. And it's up to all of us and how we engage with it and think about it to take us down the right path for that.
Well, we've had a wonderful conversation here. Very great to get your ideas with Lauren Larson, the CEO and co-founder of Bidera Health. Lauren, I just think that in the future, this is such a growth opportunity. And so much change is going to be realized. And the leadership that you're bringing to the table here is going to impact a lot of people. I'd put this in the category of being a very worthy cause, not just the business that you're in. So thank you for all that you're doing.
Thanks, Bob. Great chatting with you today.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.